You're listening to Maine Public Radio. Tonight, we have a special presentation of Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. I'm Lucy Suchek. Presented by the Chinese and American Friendship Association of Maine at Space Gallery in Portland, this program features a performance by The Slants and a discussion with Simon Tam. Simon Tam is founder and bassist of The Slants, an all-Asian American dance rock band. He is an author, musician, activist, and self-proclaimed troublemaker, known for winning a landmark civil rights case, which you'll hear about tonight. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. Welcome to the special presentation of The Slants.
Remember counting the days, remember grasping for moments. Freedom was a digit away. Remember thinking the world closed up on you like an island. Peering through sea and proof. Remember when you were teenage, staring up at the ceiling. Emotions like a runaway train. Remember making the promise to yes and not to be cautious. Flawless and wandering. Luxuries fading like the air that you're breathing. Remember when you were three, filling your lung without question. The first time that you fell in the sea, and could you ever imagine if they board up the ocean? The cracks come immediately. Mind you were 18, now you're 21. How's my rule? Now you're free.
So we got another one for you, and this one requires a little bit of audience participation. You're gonna sing along, but it's okay if you're a little nervous, because there's only one word you gotta know, and that word is no. So when we point at you, we need you to muster up all that voice, all that power, and say the word no. You wanna try it? Well, that's pretty good. So let's do it.
You
one,
pass.
Two, three. One, two, three, no. All right. Song's called From the Heart.
Sorry if our notes too sharp. Sorry if our voice too raw. We'll make the pen a weapon and censor our intelligence until our thoughts mean nothing at all. Sorry if you take offense. You never meant to play pretend. We know your fear changed. Something so strange. Nothing's gonna get in our way. There's no room for your backwards feelings and back out dealings. So never gonna settle. Never
here we go.
Gonna settle.
And no,
we won't remain silent.
No.
Such a defining moment. We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the no.
We won't be complacent.
No.
It's a rock and roll nation. We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
That was pretty good, but we can do better.
Sorry if we try too hard. Take some power back for hours. The language of oppression. We're loose to education until the words can hurt us again. Sorry if you take offense, but silence will not make amends. System's all wrong. It won't be long before the kids are singing our song. There's no room for your backwards feelings and back out. Never gonna settle, never gonna settle,
and no!
We won't remain silent,
no!
It's a defining moment, we sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the no!
We won't be complacent,
no!
It's a rock and roll nation, we sing from the heart.
And we sing from the heart.
Again.
We won't remain silent,
no.
It's a defining moment. We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the no.
We won't be complacent,
no.
It's a rock and roll nation. We sing from the heart.
We sing from the heart.
We sing from the
a cappella style. Go.
We won't remain silent,
no.
It's a defining moment. We sing from the heart. We sing from the heart.
Clap along.
No.
We won't be complacent.
No.
It's a rock and roll nation. We sing from the heart. Yeah, we sing.
I like your enthusiasm. Still clapping along.
From the heart.
From the heart.
So thank you so much for being here tonight. You know, it's really been quite a journey. I can't believe I've been doing this band for like over a decade now. Makes me feel like it's almost time to retire, but you know, that's okay because like it's been the landscape for Asian Americans in music and in the entertainment industry in general looked vastly different when I started. And as I kind of mentioned and hinted at, like I started this band because I wanted to provide representation because I saw such a lack of it. It was, especially in the last, in the first few years, such an incredible experience. Like within a couple of months of me starting this band, like announcing it to the public, we just get all this immense amount of support from Asian American youth all across this country. And I remember when that started happening, I thought, wow, like whether we like it or not, we're gonna be judged for this. So we really needed to be on top of things. And that's why I started enrolling in anti-racism classes, doing diversity, equity, and inclusion work, getting in actually even counseling classes because we had kids who were who are thinking of taking their own lives, who are bullied, who experience severe amounts of trauma in school, coming to us because, like, that's all they had. They thought, you know, there's this rock and roll band, and they're on social media, maybe I can connect with them. That was kind of the landscape up through 2008, and I still remember, like, NPR did their very first story on us. It was on All Things Considered, and they were talking about how there was this band who was turning stereotypes about Asians upside down. In fact, they even nicknamed us the Sound of Chinatown. It was the most exciting thing ever. For me as a musician, my career up to that point, getting, you know, spin on radio on like 800 stations across this country, we were really doing some really remarkable things. But of course, all of that kind of went down the drain when I became friends with an attorney. That attorney, who's still a good friend of mine today, by the way, Spencer Trowbridge, said, "Hey, Simon, you're doing all this stuff. Why don't you, have you ever thought about, you know, registering your band's trademark?" And I was like, "That sounds really expensive." But he assured me, he's like, "You know, it's only a few hundred bucks. And in like 6 months or less, this whole thing's gonna be over." Turned out a little bit different than that. You know, I'll never forget the first time he called me after we submitted this application. It was spring of 2010. He says, "Simon, we got a problem with your application." I'm like, "What is it?" He says, "Well, the government, the trademark office, they said that the name of the band is disparaging to persons of Asian descent." And of course, I took a moment. I thought, wait, does disparaging mean what I think it means? Are they saying we're racist to Asian people? And he says, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Do they know we're of Asian descent?" And he says, "I think that's pretty obvious." And I'm like, "I didn't even know there was a law against this. Like, what is it? What does it actually say?" So he proceeds to read me what's called Section 2A of the Lanham Act, which says you can't register trademarks that are considered scandalous, immoral, or disparaging. I thought, okay, you know, that's really interesting. But he says, you know, it's not just what anyone considers to be disparaging. They have to find a substantial composite of the reference group. So, of course, I've been working with the community, over 100 different social justice organizations, kind of like HAFAM, all throughout North America. Who did they find? Who was disparaged? Who was like deeply hurt by our work? Well, Spencer says, "Nobody." Like, "What do you mean nobody? You just told me, like, they got to find a substantial composite." He's like, no, nobody. But they did quote from UrbanDictionary.com. And there are photos of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant eye gesture. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. But he's like, "No, I'm looking at Miley Cyrus right now. It's pretty offensive." And I'm like, Asian Twitter was already on that. Like, you're telling me the kind of stuff that isn't even acceptable in a junior high classroom is now being used by the federal government to deny me rights? And he says, "Yeah." And so we decide to fight back. And we fight back in the same way that anyone who is denied rights under this law would fight back. We basically, you know, like, how do you, like, prove you're not offensive to yourself? that's, like, a really interesting puzzle if you really think about it. Well, we got legal declarations that are basically, like, testimonies from executive directors of numerous Asian American organizations who worked in the community. We demonstrated how every single Asian American newspaper in America loved our band. In fact, they wrote glowing reviews. They talked about all our work in the community. This carried on and on, by the way, year and a half of, like, continuing to fight back against the government. We eventually got to a point where we did a couple of independent national surveys that showed that 92% of Asian Americans supported our use of the name. We got a dictionary expert, like, not just, like, some dude who interned at Webster's Dictionary, but, like the guy. I mean, he's the president of the American Dialect Society, chief editor at the New American Oxford Dictionary. Like, the guy's CV was hundreds of pages long. The guy wrote a huge report, did a deep study on the history of the term slant, showing how even in the height of its use in the 30s and 40s, it was kind of obscure at best, but how for the last 30 years, Asian Americans were using it in this self-referential, empowering kind of way. We sent all this in, and the government said, "It's not good enough." In fact, they called the effort laudable, but not influential. They're like, it doesn't matter that 3,000 Asian Americans stepped up and provided their voices and you worked on all this stuff. It doesn't matter that it was the biggest appeal in U.S. history, because UrbanDictionary.com says it's offensive, because AsianJokes.com says it's offensive. And to kind of put a cherry on top of all that, they quoted from and used the rhetoric from two white supremacist websites. That was the first 2 years. And at that point, my attorney says, you know what? Law's really hard. I'm going to step down, so you're going to have to find someone else. So we found a different attorney who was willing to take the case up pro bono, but he says, as long as you fight like this, you're not going to win. You're going to have to change your tactic. He suggested that we reapply, and this time he said, let's use an ethnic neutral approach. So we go, we apply again, hoping that we would just get a different examining attorney, one who didn't associate slant with this like outdated kind of racial slur or stereotype. But the trademark office gives us the exact same guy. And that guy copies and pastes his previous rejection into our current one, setting our work back 2 years. I was really frustrated, but my new attorney, Ron, was really excited. He's like, no, we caught them. They just broke their own rules. You see, every time a new application comes in, they're supposed to do a fresh search. But if you look, all of the evidence predates your application by 2 years. On top of that, the government has to do like what's called a neutral search, like to see how it actually is received in context. They didn't do it in a very neutral manner. In fact, you can actually look at the screenshots of their searches, because the only time they ever found anything offensive in connection with the word slant was when they Googled slant, plus the word derogatory, plus the N-word. Although that's not how they wrote it. So we started asking them these questions. Like, we started calling them out on these very like technical issues. And we also said, wait, hold on a second. If slant is this inherent racial slur that you claim it is, how come you gave it to everybody else? You see, there were over 800 applications for the term slant, but only one in all of U.S. history was ever denied a trademark under this law, and that was me. We asked the government, and they wrote back, and they said, it's because y'all are too Asian. Their actual words were, it is incontestable that the applicant is of Asian descent and part of an Asian band. In fact, they said, like, it's not just like you guys are Asian, like your imagery is Asian too. Look, if you go to theslants.com, there's Asian people all over that website. Like, yeah, that's my face. Like, that's my band. Now they're like, but look, album covers, look, you got Rising Suns, Dragons, Pagodas. I'm like, yeah, we're using the artwork of our respective cultural heritages. But for the government, that meant we are too Asian. Follow this logic. You see, they're like, if people see the words the slants, and then they see our faces, they're all automatically going to think racial slur and not the other definitions for the word. But that's some more convoluted way of saying anyone can register the slants as long as they're not Asian. So we appealed again, called them out on these things, and it turns out that we weren't the only ones facing this issue. Think about it. Who are the kinds of people that reappropriate language? Tends to be people of color and members of the LGBTQ community. But it actually made us prime targets under this law. And I thought it was kind of hard to believe until I looked into it myself and noticed that, yeah, it's true. Every single racial slur that you could think of for an Asian person is registered as a trademark. But whenever an Asian person applied, they were denied. Same thing goes for all kinds of other words, you know, used by the LGBTQ community and other members of like people of color. So we appealed and appealed and lost every single round, all the way up to what's called the Federal Circuit, which is right below the Supreme Court. And there we finally said, you know, we think there's a constitutional issue here too, like equal protection. You can't deny people rights based on their race or because of their gender or their, you know, political affiliation or religion. Like here, they're using my race, saying that I was too Asian. And on top of that, you can't deny somebody their freedom of expression rights, the First Amendment. Well, the court said, we don't care about any of these other issues. The only thing we care about is the First Amendment. And at the Federal Circuit, we won. 9 out of 12 federal judges said that this outdated law violated our First Amendment rights. So we won. We kind of got rid of this outdated law. But it turns out that it wasn't the end of the story. Because a few months after that historic decision occurred, I learned that the Trademark Office, teaming up with their new BFFs, the Department of Justice, sued me and took me to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is, you know, like the final boss stage in any kind of legal adventure. There, we actually won unanimously, forever sealing away this particular law. Well, thank you. And so it's kind of interesting now, because that happened 2 years ago, and as we travel the country, you know, sharing these stories, playing our music, and I most recently just published a book on this whole adventure. Like, I think back about all those years. It took me 7.5 years from the first time we applied to winning at the Supreme Court before we saw any kind of justice. And if I were to pull out, like, any particular moments of this journey, it would have to be this, not the courtroom itself, but immediately after it. You see, in the courtroom, I actually felt invisible. Even though the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court were all using my name, and the Solicitor General, which is like the highest ranking attorney in the country, was using my name and the name of my band, I felt invisible because they were all talking about how we were derogatory, and how we were offensive to our community. And I just was like, you don't get it. Like, no, you weren't there as we, like, did all this work in our community. We dedicate 100% of the profits from our second album to fund research addressing the disparities of cancer rates that Asian American women face. We raise enough money to rescue a family from North Korea. We, you know, they certainly weren't there as I was counseling these kids from taking their lives to let them know that they got better. I was like, you don't deserve to use my name or the name of my band. But none of that really mattered and to me as we were walking out of the courtroom. I just thought, they don't get it. But as we walked out, and I noticed the plaza was actually filled with people outside who were waiting all night to try and get into our court case. And I thought, you know, does anyone actually really understand what we are fighting this thing for? But as we walk down the steps, the crowd looks up at us and they break out in applause. Begin cheering for us as we walked down, which really threw me off because I had no idea what they were doing. I just felt so out of it after such a surreal experience at the Supreme Court. But I'll never forget that as I hit those final steps, these two Asian kids come running up to me. And they say, Simon, our parents let us ditch school to be here. And I was like, what kind of Asian parents do you have? Like... And they're like, no. We flew from California to be here. You don't understand. Like, we waited all night in the cold on that sidewalk to be in that room, but we couldn't make it in. There were just too many people. But we want to let you know that for our whole lives, like ever since we were little kids, like we're freshmen in high school now, but like growing up, we heard about you. We heard about the one who's willing to fight for the dignity of our community to decide what's best for ourselves. We heard about the band and how you would share your own stories of being bullied and like letting us know that it would get better and how you would fight and stand up no matter how long it would take, no matter how much it would cost for these outdated laws that were used against our community. So we want you to know that when we graduate and we go to college, we're going to study public policy development. We're going to run for office and we're going to change the system. It was... like the best moment ever and being in this band. But as I go around the country sharing these stories, I like to remind people, and you know, I'm a huge NPR junkie. Like, I think that's pretty obvious. But like, know your rights. Know, like, understand them. Fight for them. Like, don't just think about what's possible. Think about the kind of world that you want to see. And for me, that it's that idea of justice, finding a world where the rules that are most fair are the ones that all of us would agree to, no matter who was in charge, no matter who is sitting in the office of the president. And for me, that means protecting our civil liberties. Each of those amendments means something. So I hope that you would study up on them, learn them. There's a great album that can help you do that, by the way. and so thank you for being here. I think we're going to have a little conversation of some questions. Come on up.
You're listening to a special presentation of Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court on Maine Public Radio. Simon Tam will now answer questions from the audience. The question and answer session is moderated by Cindy Hahn.
Thank you so much, Simon, and thank you, the Slants. Let's clap for these guys again.
Normally we play like loud rock and roll and dance rock. This is like the folky acoustic Slants version.
So. We like the folky acoustic. That was great. Thank you for sharing your story and your inspiring message and for your activism and all that you've done and for your great music. I'm just going to kick off with a couple questions. I know a lot of you probably have questions for Simon, but just listening to your story, I wonder, you know, it sounded like a very long and frustrating process. And you mentioned that you had been bullied and, you know, it seems like you did experience prejudice as a kid against Asians. What was it in you that made you keep going? You never felt like, oh, this isn't worth it. I just don't want to bother with this.
I felt that way all the time. I mean, especially as I was looking at the legal fees.
Oh, that'll do it.
Like, I mean, so my attorneys were so generous. They worked on this thing pro bono for like, you know, almost a decade. But the first, all I needed to do was cover the like court fees and filing fees. But I will tell you, the first time you get a printing bill for $11,000. It makes you really take pause and think, what did I do wrong with my life? But I had some really, really incredible mentors. Like, I was really involved with community organizations. I was a, you know, grassroots organizer. And there was a couple of folks who just really, really sharp and really compassionate thought about laws in these really unique kinds of ways. And they said, look, this is a lot bigger than you. It's a lot bigger than the band. You're in the moment. You have an opportunity to change this. You see how unjust it is, and it can be. Like, we might not get that moment again. And so they really encouraged me to think about, like, the values I wanted to express, the things I wanted to do with my life, and to fight for those values. And when I thought about it, I realized, you know, it's just money. It's just, like, a couple more years of my life. Like, I can do this. Like, at least I can say I tried with everything I had in me. To do it. And I just felt like I didn't want to walk away because, like, you know, people would ask me, like, how much does it cost to fight, like, a case that goes to the Supreme Court? And I'll tell you, it's a whole lot. But there's a much greater cost, and that's the cost of walking away, the cost that you have to live with this, that knowing that you can make a difference, but you chose not to. And so I thought, what's another 10 grand in debt? I'll get some more jobs, I'll get some more credit cards, and I'll figure out a way out of this one day.
Wow. And do you feel, a lot of your music obviously does kind of convey the message of fighting back and speaking up. So do you feel compelled now? I mean, has your music sort of changed that you sort of need to use it for your message?
I think our music's more intentional now than ever before in terms of, like, being deliberate. I mean, so we just released an album this year, but most of those songs were written in the last few years as we were watching the elections, as we were watching Asian American voices get drowned out, even as people ran for president. And we thought, we got to say something. We got to at least express these values. And on top of that, like, we can do more than that. So it's like, what do you do after you win a Supreme Court case? Well, for us, we started a nonprofit organization. So we started something called the Slants Foundation, where we now raise money to provide scholarships and mentoring for Asian American artists who want to incorporate community-driven activism into their work. I right now, as I'm on this kind of speaking and book tour, I'm actually raising money for this because I want to issue out the first scholarship, and I'm calling it the Troublemaker Scholarship. So.
Great. I'm looking to the audience now. And anybody have any questions for Simon?
Obviously, you have Asian parents, right?
Yeah. Chinese and Taiwanese.
Okay. And most Asian parents, I believe, always would like to mold their children into quote-unquote model immigrants. And I don't know, can you tell us a little bit about your parents and how do they put up with you as a troublemaker?
Sure. So in semi-stereotypical fashion, my parents wanted me to be a doctor or an engineer. The funny thing is they told me, you can never be a lawyer. You're terrible at speaking. And I ended up winning like this landmark case at the highest court of the land and now do speaking for a living. So it's really, really funny. But it's really interesting seeing their reaction because they didn't have the same experience as I did. They certainly faced a lot of racism, particularly when they first immigrated to this country. And whenever they spoke and people detected an accent, they would certainly judge and treat my parents a different kind of way. But they viewed my activism as something inherently different. Like, my dad escaped China as a political refugee. So when he learned I was fighting against the government, he was just like, are they going to put you in prison? Are you going to go to jail? And I was like, no, Dad. If they put me there, they're going to be even more trouble. And he was just like, okay, just be careful, you know? Now they are proud of me, but they, number one, still don't understand what I do for a living. And number two, are always like, have you ever thought about just leaving the band? You know, you should settle down and that sort of thing. But, you know, that it's obviously from a place of love, and that's what they know. They know about being secure and having certain comforts. Nowadays, I think they're kind of learning more and more that, like, hey, I can actually do this and be okay.
I have another one.
Sure.
There's that irony that you talked about where it's like someone telling you whether you're offended or not, that we see a lot of that right now in our society. And some of it, I think, is connected to sort of this idea of political correctness and cultural appropriation and all of that. So I'm just wondering, there are examples of things like this girl that wore a Chinese dress to her prom and it turned into this whole viral debate nationwide of whether that was... Yeah. Cultural appropriation and offensive, or if it was just her picking a nice dress. And I just wanted you to comment on sort of that whole phenomenon.
Well, I think it's interesting. I actually spent a lot of time thinking about, like, what is appropriation, what is appreciation, and the reality is that there are no fixed lines in this. There's like no clear cut rules. I think it goes back to two things: intention, like what is the intention of whatever this action is, and what is the impact on a particular community group? Because we know actually Boston, just a couple hours away, had another incident a couple years ago where they had this kimono on display, and people could take pictures with the kimono and interact with it, and a lot of people protested it here in the U.S., but people in Japan were like, no. Like, we love it. This is great. Our kimono culture is dying. We need to export this thing. So it really shows that there are going to be different opinions on something based on people's experiences on it. Now, what I would encourage everyone who, you know, should you choose to engage in those, like, very dark and stormy waters, is to do it with a lens of compassion. If someone does take issue with something, of someone, you know, co-opting traditional and, you know, perhaps sacred garments, like, think about why someone would be upset by it. And if someone feels like hurt because they feel like they're doing it as an honorific, like, why and how can you engage with them on that particular level? I think more important than, like, what's, you know, people kind of arguing about what is offensive or isn't offensive is how could we do a better job to make sure that as a culture we can celebrate all these different beautiful forms of diversity and pay service to them. So there's no doubt that one of the concerns of me winning my case was that it would inadvertently benefit Dan Snyder, who's the owner of the Washington football team. And that's because for many years, the Native American community had some activists who were in a legal dispute to get their registered trademarks canceled. And, you know, with me winning, it meant that that lawsuit essentially had to be dropped. There's a couple of things I think is important to remember. One is actually how trademark law works. Because had the Native American activists been successful and actually sued and won in court and got the mascots canceled, the registrations for them canceled, it would not have forced the team to change its name. They still wouldn't change their name, and in fact, they wouldn't even lose any of their trademark rights because of the what's called trademark equity. So if that's the objective, it wasn't working. And so I started thinking about it like in these particular terms, like what is justice? Is justice only punishing people who take our rights for granted and perhaps abuse them? Or is it providing a greater voice for those who have the fewest resources in our society? And as I kind of ventured and kind of endured this long legal journey, I asked many of my mentors, and they said, no, it's about providing equity, more power for those who don't have the resources to fight. Because even though the Washington football team was locked in this battle for decades, this is how much it affected Dan Snyder. Zero. He didn't even have to pay any legal fees. The NFL was footing the bill for all of these things. So it's not a particularly effective way to create the change that one seeks. That being said, I think the effort is really important because it raised a lot of awareness that needed to be raised. I mean, even here in Maine, y'all just passed a law basically banning mascots from schools, which I think is really, really incredible. And so we need more community-led efforts because that's actually what's creating change. If you think about it, over the last 5 years, more mascots have fallen, more mascots using human beings like as mascots have been removed from schools and professional sports teams than ever before. And it didn't come from courts. It came from people having conversations, engaging, and saying, like, is this actually what you want to do as a community? Is this how you want to, like, dehumanize people? And the more those conversations are raised, the more people realize that's not what we want our children to see as examples of justice. So I think that, you know, in particular with, like, Native American mascots and other kind of offensive marks, it just happened to be a differing legal strategy, but our values remain the same. We've always supported removing mascots. You know, Asian Americans have experienced this too. There are many team names that used to be called the Orientals and the Chinks. Most of them are now called the Dragons. But like, you know, it's an issue that affects our communities as well.
I just want to comment on what you said about the mascots here in Maine, because I felt like that's so parallel to your story here in Skowhegan, Maine, where the mascot was the Indians. And even though that law passed, their community was still fighting that to keep the name and say, you know, they're honoring the Indian community by keeping the name, whereas they had people from the Native American community saying, well, we're offended by it. So it's the same idea of telling somebody else not to be offended.
Yeah, let the community affected decide, not the people, right. Just the people in charge. Right. I think I'm still kind of figuring out what's next. I think for me, the thing I'm really passionate about right now is launching this nonprofit, and that takes a lot of work. You know, I got a wonderful board of directors, but we're deep in fundraising mode. We're writing for grants to try and get this whole thing launched. So that's kind of where my immediate focus is right now. And actually, it's a great transition into one thing that we wanted to do. I don't know where Joe went off to.
If he's
hiding. Hello. Oh, he's hiding there. So we actually got asked by a director and writer who's active in the Broadway stage to work on a Broadway musical. And so we've been composing music for that, and there might be talks of a particular film as well. So it might be just taking this same kind of stuff and allowing it to kind of launch other pieces of art. But I'll say the other thing is that Joe and I are working on another album, but it's not like a traditional band album where we get our regular band members to to play the songs. We're actually inviting collaborators and performers from throughout America. We want different Asian Americans to come and join us and record on this album so that we can use our platform to raise them up. Like, I don't think I could do this forever. Like, touring endlessly kind of eats away at me in a way now that it hasn't before, but I can at least like say, hey, there's a whole nother generation of all these really talented folks, and to give them that platform. So one thing that we wanted to do to kind of close out the night with is to share that future with all of you. If you're interested in hearing a song from our Broadway musical, yeah? Okay.
I already put on my guitar, so I'm really hoping that people have clapped.
Or said yes. What if they said no? What if they booed?
I just put my guitar down.
Oh, okay.
Good. Now thank everyone for being here.
So yeah, I can't believe it's been over a year, but someone came up to me and sent me a message and said, like, hey, I've worked on musicals like Les Miserables, Rent, Phantom of the Opera. Have you heard of these? And I'm like, yes, I've heard of these things. And he says, I want to write a musical about your life, about your journey, because he heard me on Planet Money or some other NPR thing. And I said, sure, but please do not write this musical about a white band. I was like, it's got to be about an Asian American band. Like, that's all I care about. And then you can run off and do your musical. So I started answering a bunch of questions through email. And through our exchanges, he wanted me to, like, participate in this more and more. So I was like, well, at least write the music for this thing. And so as we developed these different scenes, as he pulled different moments from my life, we came up with this song that Joe and I have been playing and working on. I don't know if it'll actually end up in the full thing or not, but if it does, you'll get to say you heard it first, like long before it hits Broadway. So imagine that we are not in the Space Gallery, but we're actually somewhere off of Broadway, one of the theaters, maybe the Eugene O'Neill. And on stage, the set, it looks like a Chinese restaurant, because that's kind of where I grew up. My parents owned one. In this particular musical, my band is there because my parents feed my band, since we're starving musicians, literally. And in this scene, I am frustrated. I'm tired of, like, not making any money, and I'm more than not, I'm just really tired of being in a band of people who don't appreciate what we're doing. That's okay, though, because as I'm about to quit, I actually have a new band, and that's to start a new idea, and that's to start this Asian American band. So this is about that particular moment, and me singing to my old band, saying hello to my future.
2 years and 100 gigs, all I got is a demo and a beat up rig. Why the hell did I drop out of school for this? 40 bucks and 40 fights, we split up love but never saw our name in lights. I gave everything but only got regrets. I'm sick of pleasing everyone. I'm gonna write new songs, I'm gonna change our sound. I'm gonna take a chance, I'm gonna take a stand. I'm gonna start again, I'm gonna start again. Gonna start a new band. I can see it all so clearly. I want the world to stop and hear me. No apologies. I can feel the rhythm building like the bulls my heart is beating. I sing the song I sing.
So here's the thing, that ever since I was a little kid, I dreamt of being a musician. Instead of playing games like Cops and Robbers or Hide and Go Seek, I would grab my two cousins and my sister, and we would play band. We would gather up all that junk mail in my parents' living room, spread them out across the floor, and create a stage. And then we would get toy pianos, pots and pans, whatever noise-making devices we could find, and scream at the top of our lungs, because that's what I thought rock stars did. I remember looking at that television set at MTV, because they used to play music videos back then, and thinking, Mom, that's gonna be me one day.
Since 4 years old, I've had this dream. Built a Roxy stage from photos of a magazine. I said, Mom, one day I'll be on MTV. Yes, I played till my fingers bleed, but that's no way to earn a PhD. If he only knew what that doubt did to me. Well, I'm sick of pleasing everyone. I'm gonna storm the street, I'm gonna start some trouble. Gonna take a chance, I'm gonna take a stand. I'm gonna start again, I'm gonna start again. Gonna start a new band. I can see it all so clearly. I want the world to stop and hear me. No apologies. I can feel the rhythm melting, like the bulls my heart is beating. I'll sing the song I sing. I know this has not been done. Our faces are hidden, our voices unspoken, but I'm not just anyone. Yeah, they'll know our names, we'll have representation. The unheard will stand and rock on.
Here's the thing. I actually, 2 months before graduating at UC Riverside on a double major on a full ride scholarship, decided to drop out and join a touring punk rock band. So the idea of me starting yet another band, well, my parents aren't exactly crazy about that idea.
You think you're such a punk rock roller, but Simon, you are getting older. Where is your degree?
When you have a wife and baby, and a big house in the city, it's called responsibility.
But you know, I still believe in this dream.
10 years from now, believe on the center stage, I'll sing for our community. Maybe then you'll see what I was meant to be. Talk about responsibility. About the music, you're so full of greed. But you never take that dream away from me. I can see it all so clearly. I want the world to stop and hear me. No apologies. I can feel the rhythm melting, like the bulls my heart is beating. Sing the song I sing.
So in this particular scene now, all the restaurant workers come out from the back, from the kitchen, into the front area. They're actually my relatives because they all work for my parents. They decide to take a side. And you know what? They're supporting my parents. So they decide to admonish me using the power of song. Now, we would like to invite you to join. Pretend you are in the cast, supporting my parents as well. All you gotta sing is just a few words. Simon, you are getting older. So let's try it.
Older, Simon, you are getting older. Simon, you are getting old.
And sing it directly as Simon.
Simon, you are definitely getting old.
Keep singing.
Simon,
I can see it all so clearly.
You
I want the world to
I'll sing for our community, and maybe then you'll see what I was meant to be.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're the Slants.
You've been listening to Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court, on Maine Public Radio. Today, you heard from Simon Tam, founder and bassist of The Slants. Music in this hour comes from The Slants. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this special, and it was edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.